reality program called The Apprentice. On The Apprentice, Trump's signature line was, "You're fired." In professional wrestling, a hero known as a face battles his exact opposite, a villain known as a heel. Every time they meet, they act out another chapter of their story together. They say their lines, they take their bows. Not long into Obama's presidency, Trump began staging bouts, as if he were the face and the president his heel. He taunted, he smirked, he swaggered. He wanted Obama to be fired. Early in 2011, he called for Obama to release to the public his long-form birth certificate, intimating that the president had something to hide. "He doesn't have a birth certificate, or if he does, there's something on that certificate that is very bad for him," Trump said. "Now, somebody told me, and I have no idea if this is bad for him or not, but perhaps it would be, that where it says religion, it might have Muslim." These performances reached a ready-made audience. If the polls could be trusted, a dubious proposition. Even before Trump began his imaginary bout with Obama, more than 2 in 5 Republicans believed that the president was either definitely or probably born in another country. Another difficult-to-credit poll reported that more than 1 in 3 Americans believed, about that time, that it was either somewhat likely or very likely that federal officials either participated in the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon or took no action to stop them. Both the truther conspiracy theory and the birther conspiracy theory had long been peddled by Alex Jones. By 2011, by which time the Drudge Report had begun linking to InfoWars, Jones's audience was bigger than the audience of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck put together. Jones had no use for either man. "What a whore Limbaugh is," he said. "Our investigation of the purported Obama birth certificate released by Hawaiian authorities today reveals the document is a shoddily contrived hoax," Jones wrote after the White House released the long-form certificate at the end of April 2011. The Drudge Report linked to the story. After the release, another Gallup poll reported, again dubiously, that nearly 1 in 4 Republicans still believed that Obama was definitely or probably born outside of the United States. On February 26, 2012, in a national atmosphere of racial incitement, a 28-year-old man named George Zimmerman, prowling around the neighborhood outside of Orlando, Florida, called 911 to report seeing a real suspicious guy. He'd seen 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, who was walking to a nearby store. Zimmerman got out of his car and shot Martin, who was unarmed, with a 9mm handgun. Zimmerman told the police that Martin attacked him. Zimmerman weighed 250 pounds. Martin weighed 140. Martin's family said that the boy, heard over a cell phone, had begged for his life. Martin did not survive. Zimmerman was not charged for 6 weeks. On March 8th, Trayvon Martin's father, Tracy Martin, held a press conference in Orlando and demanded the release of the recordings of the calls to 911. "We feel justice has not been served," he said. Martin's death might not have gained national attention if it had not been for yet another shooting. The day after George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old boy named T.J. Lane walked into the cafeteria at Chardon High School, about 30 miles outside of Cleveland, pulled out a .22-caliber pistol and fired, killing 3 students and badly injuring 2 more. By then, the United States had the highest rate of private gun ownership in the world, twice that of the country with the second highest rate, which was Yemen. The United States also had the highest homicide rate of any affluent democracy, nearly 4 times higher than France or Germany, 6 times higher than the United Kingdom. In the United States at the start of the 21st century, guns were involved in 2/3 of all murders. None of these facts had dissuaded the Supreme Court from ruling in 2008 in District of Columbia versus Heller that D.C.'s 1975 Firearms Control Regulations Act was unconstitutional, Justice Scalia writing, "The Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in a militia." Anticipating openings on the court, the new head of the NRA told American Riflemen that the 2012 presidential election was perhaps the most crucial election from a Second Amendment standpoint in our lifetimes. There were shootings on street corners, in shopping malls, in hospitals, in movie theaters, and in churches. The nation had been mourning shootings in schools since 1999, when 2 seniors at a high school in Columbine, Colorado, shot and killed 12 students, a teacher, and themselves. In 2007, 23-year-old Seung Hui Cho, a senior at Virginia Tech, shot 50 people in Blacksburg, killing 32 people before he killed himself. The shooting in an Ohio high school the day after Martin was killed in Florida was, by comparison with Virginia Tech, a lesser tragedy. But it cast in a very dark light the claims coming out of Florida that George Zimmerman had a right to shoot Trayvon Martin. Between 1980 and 2012, 49 states had passed laws allowing gun owners to carry concealed weapons outside their homes for personal protection. Illinois was the sole holdout. In 2004, Bush had allowed the 1994 Brady Bill's ban on the possession, transfer, or manufacture of semi-automatic assault weapons to expire. In 2005, Florida passed a Stand Your Ground law, exonerating from prosecution citizens who used deadly force when confronted by an assailant, even if they could have safely retreated. More states followed. Carrying a concealed weapon for self-defense came to be understood not as a failure of civil society to be mourned, but as an act of citizenship to be vaunted. Law and order, man by man. Obama refused to cede this argument. "If I had a son," the president said at a press conference on March 23rd, visibly shaken, "he'd look like Trayvon." Later that day, Rick Santorum, a Republican presidential aspirant, spoke outside a firing range in West Monroe, Louisiana, where he shot 14 rounds from a Colt 45. He told the crowd, "What I was able to do was exercise one of those fundamental freedoms that's guaranteed in our Constitution, the right to bear arms." A woman called out, "Pretend it's Obama!" On April 2nd, thousands of students rallied in Atlanta, carrying signs that read, "I am Trayvon Martin," and "Don't shoot." Even as they were rallying, a 43-year-old man named Juan Go walked into a classroom in a small Christian college in Oakland, took out a .45-caliber semi-automatic pistol, lined the students against the wall, said, "I'm going to kill you all," and fired. That same morning in Tulsa, five people were shot on the street. An investigation called Operation Random Shooter led the Tulsa police to Jake England, 19, whose father had been shot to death 2 years before. By Easter Sunday, two college students had been shot to death in Mississippi. On March 20th, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it would conduct an investigation into the death of Trayvon Martin. On April 7th, Martin's parents appeared on Good Morning America. 5 days later, Newt Gingrich, seeking the 2012 Republican nomination, called the Second Amendment a universal human right. Trump found this a suitable moment to cast doubt once more on the president's birth certificate. "A lot of people do not think it was an authentic certificate," Trump said that May, just before endorsing Mitt Romney as the GOP nominee. Obama won election in 2012, even as Democrats lost control of the Senate. Weeks later, on a woeful day in December in the snow-dusted New England town of Newtown, Connecticut, a mentally ill 20-year-old shot his mother and then went to his former elementary school, fully armed. He shot and killed 6 teachers and staff and 20 very young children, as young as 5, a massacre of first graders. "I know there's not a parent in America who doesn't feel the same overwhelming grief that I do," Obama said at the White House. He could not stop himself from weeping. "Our hearts are broken." And yet the Obama administration had no success getting gun safety measures through a Republican Congress, which staunchly defended the right to bear arms at all costs, calling the massacre of little children the price of freedom. Obama's second term was marked by battles over budgets and the mire of the Middle East. In 2011, U.S. forces had found and killed Osama bin Laden, and Obama withdrew the last American troops from Iraq. Yet Obama's foreign policy looked aimless and haphazard and tentative, which diminished both his stature and that of his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. While war in Afghanistan wore on, Islamic militants attacked U.S. government facilities in Libya in 2012, and by 2014, a new terrorist group calling itself the Islamic State had gained control of territory in Iraq. America's nation-building project in the Middle East had failed. Obama, who had been an early critic of the Patriot Act, of the prison at Guantanamo, and of the Iraq War, led an administration that stepped up surveillance through a secret program run by the National Security Agency, prosecuted whistleblowers who leaked documents that revealed U.S. abuses in the Middle East, and used drones to commit assassinations. Critics argued that the war on terror had been an unmitigated disaster, that occupying Arab countries had only produced more terrorists, and that the very idea of a war on terror was an error. "Terrorism is a criminal act," historian Andrew Bacevich argued, "and required police action and diplomacy, not military action." With a massive defense budget, the federal government proved unmovable on tax policy and all but unable even to discuss its spending priorities. House Leader Paul Ryan, a Wisconsin Republican, proposed capping the top income tax rate at 25%, a rate not seen in the United States since the days of Andrew Mellon. Of 248 Republican members of Congress and 47 Republican senators, all but 13 signed a pledge swearing to oppose any income tax increase. The Obama administration wanted to raise the top rate to 39%, a recommendation supported by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. But Senate Republicans objected to the CRS's report, finding, for instance, the phrase tax cuts for the rich to be biased. And in a move without precedent in the century-long history of the Congressional Research Service, forced the report's withdrawal. While Congress fought over the implications of the phrase tax cuts for the rich, political scientists raised a distressing question. How much inequality of wealth and income can a democracy bear? In 2004, a task force for the American Political Science Association had concluded that growing economic inequality was threatening fundamental American political institutions. 4 years later, a 700-page collection of scholarly essays presented its argument as its title, The Unsustainable American State. A 2013 report by the United Nations reached the conclusion that growing income inequality was responsible not only for political instability around the world, but also for the slowing of economic growth worldwide. The next year, when the Pew Research Center conducted its annual survey about which of the five dangers people in 44 countries considered to be the greatest threat to the world, most countries polled put religious and ethnic hatred at the top of their lists, but Americans chose inequality. As the 2016 election neared, inequality seemed poised to gain the candidate's full attention. Bernie Sanders, seeking the Democratic nomination, would make inequality the centerpiece of his campaign, leading a movement that called for progressive-style economic reform. But Hillary Clinton, the eventual Democratic nominee, would fail to gain any real traction on the problem. And the unlikely Republican nominee, Donald Trump, would blame immigrants. A movement to fight gun violence began during Obama's second term, but it wasn't a gun control movement. It was a movement for racial justice. In 2013, after a jury in Florida acquitted George Zimmerman of all charges relating to the death of Trayvon Martin, organizers began tweeting under the hashtag Black Lives Matter. African Americans had been fighting against domestic terrorism, state violence, and police brutality since before the days of Ida B. Wells' anti-lynching crusade. Black Lives Matter was black power, with disruptively innovative technologies, smartphones and apps that could capture and stream candid footage live over the internet. If stand-your-ground laws encouraged vigilantism, data service providers encouraged do-it-yourself reporting. Newt Gingrich insisted that the Second Amendment was a human right, but data plans promoted the idea that all users of the internet were reporters, every man his own muckraker, and that uploading data was itself a human right. A billion roaming photojournalists uploading the human experience, and it is spectacular, said the voiceover in an ad for a data plan over images of a vast mosaic of photographs. My iPhone 5 can see every point of view, every panorama, the entire gallery of humanity. I have the right to be unlimited. Black Lives Matter made visible through photography the experience of African Americans, maybe even in the very way that Frederick Douglass had predicted a century and a half earlier. With photography, witnesses and even the victims themselves captured the experiences of young black men who for generations had been singled out by police, pulled over in cars, stopped on street corners, pushed, frisked, punched, kicked, and even killed. In 2014, police in Ferguson, Missouri, not far from St. Louis, shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown in the middle of the street. Witnesses captured the shooting on their smartphones. All over the country, witnesses captured one police shooting after another. Police shot and killed Tamir Rice, age 12, in a city park in Cleveland. He was carrying a toy gun. Minnesota police shot and killed Philando Castile in his car. He had a licensed handgun in his glove compartment and was trying to tell them about it. Castile's girlfriend live-streamed the shooting. "Social media helps Black Lives Matter fight the power," announced Wired. Yet legal victories eluded the movement. One killing after another was captured on film and posted on the internet, but in nearly all cases where officers were charged with wrongdoing, they were acquitted. Black Lives Matter called urgent attention to state-sanctioned violence against African Americans in forms that included police brutality, racially discriminatory sentencing laws, and mass incarceration. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the movement did not make gun control legislation a priority, not least because its forebears included the Black Panthers, who had argued that black men had to arm themselves and advanced the argument by interpreting the Second Amendment in a way that would later be adopted by the NRA. Meanwhile, hair-trigger fights along the battle lines first drawn in the 1970s over guns and abortion continue to be waged on the streets and at the ballot box, but especially in the courts. A pattern emerged. Second Amendment rights, a de facto rights fight led for and by white men, gained strength. Civil rights for black people, women, and immigrants stalled and even fell back. And gay rights advanced. In the early years of the 21st century, while other civil rights claims failed, the gay rights movement, newly styled the LGBT movement, won signal legal victories, chiefly by appropriating the pro-family rhetoric that had carried conservatives to victories since Phyllis Schlafly's Stop ERA campaign. In 2003, in Lawrence v. Texas, the Supreme Court overruled its 1986 decision in Bowers by declaring a Texas sodomy law unconstitutional. In a concurring opinion, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said she based her decision on a 14th Amendment equal protection argument, asserting that the Texas law constituted sex discrimination. A man could not be prosecuted for engaging in a particular activity with a woman, but could be prosecuted for engaging in that same activity with a man. O'Connor's reasoning marked the way forward for LGBT litigation, which turned increasingly to marriage equality. Less than a year after the ruling in Lawrence, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court made the Commonwealth the first state to guarantee same-sex marriage as a constitutional right. The Brown v. Board for Same-Sex Marriage came in the spring of 2015, 50 years after the court's landmark decision on contraception in Griswold v. Connecticut. The case, Obergefell v. Hodges, consolidated the petitions of four couples who had sought relief from state same-sex marriage bans in Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee. In 2004, Ohio passed a law stating that only a union between one man and one woman may be a marriage valid or recognized by the state. Ohioans James Obergefell and John Arthur had been together for nearly 20 years when Arthur was diagnosed with ALS, a wrenching and terminal illness, in 2011. In 2013, they flew to Maryland, a state without a same-sex marriage ban, and were married on the tarmac at the airport. Arthur died 4 months later, at the age of 48. To his widower, he was, under Ohio law, a stranger. In its ruling in Obergefell v. Hodges, the Supreme Court declared state bans on same-sex marriage unconstitutional. At New York's Stonewall Inn, the movement's holy site, people gathered by candlelight, hugged one another, and wept. It had been a long and dire struggle, and yet the victory, when it came, felt as unexpected and as sudden as the fall of the Berlin Wall. One minute there was a wall, the next, sky. A triumph for a half-century of litigation over reproductive and gay rights, Obergefell marked, for conservative Christians, a landmark defeat in a culture war that had begun with the sexual revolution of the 1960s. Between Griswold and Obergefell, Christians had joined and transformed the Republican Party, and yet had not succeeded in stopping a tectonic cultural shift. Many felt betrayed and even abandoned by a secular world hostile to the basic tenets of their faith. Conservative Christians had long identified Hollywood for its celebrating sex and violence on film and television as an agent of that change. But as entertainment, including pornography, moved online, conservative Christians, like everyone else, began to wonder about the effects of the Internet on belief, tradition, and community. In a book outlining A Strategy for Christians in a Post-Christian Nation, Rod Dreher, an editor at the American Conservative, wrote, "To use technology is to participate in a cultural liturgy that, if we aren't mindful, trains us to accept the core truth claim of modernity, that the only meaning there is in the world is what we choose to assign it in our endless quest to master nature." Exactly what role the Internet had played in the political upheaval of the first decades of the 21st century remained uncertain. But in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, Americans believed in conspiracies and feared invasions. Different people feared different conspiracies, but their fears took the same form. Intruders had snuck into American life and undermined American democracy. Wasn't that invader the Internet itself? Cyberutopians said no, and pointed to Obama's 2008 campaign, the Tea Party, the Occupy movement, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, and political hackers from Anonymous to WikiLeaks as evidence that the long-predicted democratization of politics had at last arrived. A new information enlightenment is dawning, Heather Brook wrote, and the revolution will be digitized. Technology is breaking down traditional social barriers of status, class, power, wealth, and geography, replacing them with an ethos of collaboration and transparency. Instead, social media had provided a breeding ground for fanaticism, authoritarianism, and nihilism. It had also proved to be easily manipulated, not least by foreign agents. On the internet, everything looked new, even though most of it was very old. The alt-right, a term coined in 2008 by Richard Spencer, was nothing so much as the old right with roots in the anti-civil rights Ku Klux Klan of the 1860s and the anti-immigration Klan of the 1920s. It stole its style, edgy and pornographic, from the counterculture of the 1960s. The alt-right, less influenced by conservatism than by the sexual revolution, considered itself to be transgressive, a counterculture that had abandoned the moralism of the moral majority, or any kind of moralism, and deemed the security state erected by neoconservatives to be insufficient to the class of civilizations. Instead, it favored authoritarianism. Spencer had been a history PhD student at Duke before leaving in 2007 to become an editor and a leader of what he described as a movement of consciousness and identity for European people in the 21st century. The alt-right, fueled by the ideology of white supremacy and by disgust with establishment conservatism, turned misogyny into a rhetorical style and made opposition to immigration its chief policy issue. By 2011, Spencer became president of the National Policy Institute, whose website announced in 2014, "Immigration is a kind of proxy war and maybe a last stand for white Americans who are undergoing a painful recognition that unless dramatic action is taken, their grandchildren will live in a country that is alien and hostile." But the only thing that was new about the alt-right was the home it found online, on forums like Reddit, and especially 4chan, where users, mostly younger white men, mocked PC culture, bemoaned the decline of Western civilization, attacked feminism, trolled women, used neo-Nazi memes, and posted pornography. And also on new disruptive media sites, especially Breitbart, which was started in 2007, and was for a time one of the most popular websites in the United States. The alt-right's online counterpart, sometimes called the alt-left, had one foot in the online subculture of Tumblr and other platforms, and the other foot in the campus politics of endless pieties over smaller and smaller stakes. If the favored modes of the alt-right were the woman-hating troll and the neo-Nazi meme, the favored modes of the alt-left were clickbait and the call-out, sentimental, meaningless outrage, 8 signs your yoga practice is culturally appropriated, and sanctimonious accusations of racism, sexism, homophobia, and transphobia. In 2014, Facebook offered users more than 50 different genders to choose from in registering their identities. People who were baffled by this were accused online of prejudice. Public shaming as a mode of discourse was every bit as much a part of the online far left as it was of the online far right, if not more. After 14 people were killed in a terrorist attack on a gay nightclub in San Bernardino, California, the alt-left spent its energies in the aftermath of this tragedy, attacking one another for breaches of the rules of intersectionality, which involve intricate, identity-based hierarchies of suffering and virtue. One Twitter-famous intersectionalist admonished those who had called it the worst mass shooting in U.S. history by reminding them that the worst was Wounded Knee, the writer Angela Nagel reported. Other similar tweeters raged against the use of the term Latina, Latino, instead of Latinx in the reporting, while still others made sure to clarify that it was the shooter's mental illness, not his allegiance to ISIS and the caliphate, that caused the shooting. Not to be outdone, others then tweeted back angrily about the ableism of those that said the shooter had a mental illness. Millennials, a generation of Americans who grew up online, found their political style on the internet. At the time of the 2016 election, a majority of younger eligible voters got their news from Facebook's news feed, which had been launched in 2006. Not many of them, fewer than in any generation before them, believed in political parties or churches or public service. The mantra of the counterculture, question authority, had lost its meaning. Few institutions any longer wielded authority. Sellers of data plans suggested that people could upload all of themselves onto the internet, a self of selfies and posts, an abdication of community and of inquiry. Sellers of search engines suggested that all anyone needed to know could be found out with a click. Eventually, you'll have an implant, Google co-founder Larry Page promised, where if you think about a fact, it will just tell you the answer. But online, where everyone was in the end utterly alone, it had become terribly difficult to know much of anything with any certainty, except how to like and be liked, and especially how to hate and be hated. 3. I've sat around these tables with some of these other guys before, Jeb Bush's campaign manager said. In a room about the size of a tennis court, its walls painted martini olive green, the campaign managers of the candidates for President of the United States in 2016 sat around a broad conference table to debrief after the election. They were warriors after the war, standing atop a mountain of dead, remorseless. They had gathered at Harvard's Kennedy School, as campaign managers had done after every presidential election since 1972, for a two-day tell-all. Most of what they said was shop talk. Some of it was loose talk. No one said a word about the United States or its government or the common good. Sitting in that room watching was like being a pig at a butcher's convention. There was much talk of the latest technology and knives and the best and tastiest cuts of meat, but no one pretended to bear any love for the pig. The election of 2016 was a product of technological disruption. The most significant form of political communication during the campaign was Donald Trump's Twitter account. It involved a crisis in the press, whose standards of evidence and accountability were challenged by unnamed sources and leaks, some of which turned out to have been part of a campaign of political interference waged by the Russian government in what came to be called troll factories. The election dredged from the depths of American politics the rank muck of ancient hatreds. It revealed the dire consequences of a dwindling middle class. It suggested the cost to the Republic's political stability of the unequal constitutional status of women. It marked the end of the conservative Christian coalition, and it exposed the bleak emptiness of both major political parties. 17 candidates had vied for the Republican nomination. At the debrief, the campaign managers talked about their candidates and the campaign the way jockeys talk about their horses and the conditions on the racetrack. "Our strategy was to keep our head down," said Florida Senator Marco Rubio's manager. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's manager said, "The path was going to be the long game." Ted Cruz's manager talked about what lane his horse was racing in. Trump's former campaign manager, CNN analyst Corey Lewandowski, spoke the longest. His horse was the best, the prettiest, the fastest, and ran the most unconventional race in the history of the presidency. He told a story, likely apocryphal, about how in 2012 Mitt Romney had been driven in a limo to campaign events, but then at the last minute he'd jump into a Chevy. Not Trump. Trump went everywhere in his jet. "Our goal was to make sure we were going to run as the populist, to run on our wealth and not run from it, and to monopolize the media attention by using social media unlike anybody else," Lewandowski gloated. "What we know is that when Donald Trump put out a tweet, Fox News would cover it live." Field organizing was over, he said. Newspapers, newspaper advertisements, irrelevant, he said. "Donald Trump buys ink by the television station," he said. Trump hadn't run in any lane. Trump had run from a plane. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham's campaign manager pointed out that much had turned on Fox News' decision to use polls to determine who participated in the primary debates and where each candidate would stand on the stage and how much camera time each candidate would get. In the 2016 election, the polls had been a scandal of near Dewey beats Truman proportion, a scandal that people in the industry had seen coming. During the 2012 presidential election, 1,200 polling organizations had conducted 37,000 polls by making more than 3 billion phone calls. Most Americans, more than 90%, had refused to speak to them. Mitt Romney's pollsters had believed, even on the morning of the election, that Romney would win. A 2013 study, a poll, found that 3 out of 4 Americans distrusted polls. But 9 out of 10 people, presumably, distrusted the polls so much that they had refused to answer the question, which meant that the results of that poll meant nothing at all. "Election polling is a near crisis," a past president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research had written just months before the 2016 election. When George Gallup founded the polling industry in the 1930s, the response rate, the number of people who answer a pollster as a percentage of those who are asked, was well above 90. By the 1980s, it had fallen to about 60%. By the election of 2016, the response rate had dwindled to the single digits. Time and again, predictions failed. In 2015, polls failed to predict Benjamin Netanyahu's victory in Israel, the Labour Party's loss in the United Kingdom, and a referendum in Greece. In 2016, polls failed to predict Brexit, the vote to withdraw Great Britain and Northern Ireland from the European Union. The more unreliable the polls became, the more the press and the parties relied on them, which only made them less reliable. In 2015, during the primary season, Fox News announced that in order to participate in its first primetime debate, Republican candidates had to place in the top 10 of an average of the 5 most recent national polls, and that where the candidates would be placed on the stage would be determined by their polling numbers. Standing in the polls had earlier been used to exclude third-party candidates from debates, a practice that had led to a raft of complaints filed with the Federal Election Commission, but not major party candidates. The Republican National Committee didn't object, but the decision had alarmed reputable polling organizations. The Marist Institute for Public Opinion Research called the Fox News plan a bad use of public polls. Scott Keeter, Pew's director of survey research, said, "I just don't think polling is really up to the task of deciding the field for the headliner debate." Pew, Gallup, and the Wall Street Journal NBC pollsters refused to participate. Polls admitted Trump to the GOP debates, polls placed him at center stage, and polls declared him the winner. "Donald J. Trump dominates time poll," the Trump campaign posted on its website following the first debate, referring to a story in which Time reported that 47% of respondents to a survey it had conducted said that Trump had won. Time's poll was conducted by PlayBuzz, a viral content provider that embedded quizzes, polls, lists, and other playful formats onto websites to attract traffic. PlayBuzz collected about 70,000 votes from visitors to Time's website in an instant opt-in internet poll. Time posted this warning: "The results of this poll are not scientific." Less reputable websites did not bother with disclaimers. Efforts to call attention to the weakness of the polls or to make distinctions between one kind of poll and another were both unsuccessful and half-hearted. The New York Times ran a story called "Presidential Polls: How to Avoid Getting Fooled." Polls drove polls. Good polls drove polls, and bad polls drove polls, and when bad polls drove good polls, they weren't so good anymore. Then, too, warning their readers, listeners, and viewers about the problems with polls hadn't prevented news organizations from compounding them. In August 2015, the day after the first GOP debate, Slate published a column titled, "Did Trump Actually Win the Debate? How to Understand All Those Instant Polls That Say Yes." Even as Slate conducted its own instant poll, "Now that the first Republican presidential debate is over, pundits and politicos will be gabbing about what it all means for each candidate's campaign. Who triumphed? Who floundered? Who will ride the debate? Who will ride the debate to electoral glory? And who is fated to fizzle?" They made the same populist promises Gallup had made in the 1930s. "TV talking heads won't decide this election," promised Slate's pollster, whose title was Interactivity's editor. "The American people will." Every major polling organization miscalled the 2016 election, predicting a win for Hillary Clinton. It had been a narrow contest. Clinton won the popular vote. Trump won in the Electoral College. The Kennedy School post-election debrief served as one of the earliest formal reckonings with what exactly had happened. After the Republican campaign managers finished taking stock, the Democrats spoke. "Hillary, a lot of people don't recall, came to her electoral politics late in her career," her campaign manager, Robbie Mook, said. "She got her start with the Children's Defense Fund." Clinton's campaign had failed to say much of anything new about Hillary Clinton, a candidate Americans knew only too well. Mook, apparently, had little to add. Bernie Sanders' manager looked wan. He shook his head. "We almost did it." The more obvious explanations for Clinton's loss went, on the whole, unstated. Obama had failed to raise up a new generation of political talent. The Democratic National Committee, believing Clinton's nomination and even her victory to be inevitable, had suppressed competition. Clinton, dedicating her time to fundraising with wealthy coastal liberals from Hollywood and the Hamptons, failed to campaign in swing states and hardly bothered to speak to blue-collar white voters. After Trump won their nomination, she failed to do much of anything except to call out his flaws of character, even though Trump's most vocal supporters had pointed out from the very beginning that a call-out approach would fail. The Clinton campaign believed Trump's political career had come to an end when an audio recording was leaked in which he said that the best way to approach women was to grab them by the pussy. But even this hadn't stopped conservative Christians from supporting him. Although the media tried to portray Trump's personality as a cult of personality, ironically, the one thing voters weren't wild about was his personality, wrote Ann Coulter in Trump We Trust, a hastily written campaign polemic that, like her earlier work, waved aside even the vaguest interest in evidence. I'm too busy to footnote. As for charges of Trump's depravity and deceit, Coulter rightly predicted that his supporters would be untroubled. There's nothing Trump can do that won't be forgiven, she wrote, except change his immigration policies. Phyllis Schlafly, the grand dame of American conservatism, had provided Trump with one of his earliest and most important endorsements at a rally in St. Louis in March of 2016. At 91, her voice quavered, but her powers were undiminished. In a pink blazer, her blonde bouffant as flawless as ever, she told the crowd that Trump was a true conservative. Trump, to Schlafly, represented the culmination of a movement she had led for so long, from the anti-communist crusade of the 1950s and the Goldwater campaign of the 1960s, to stop ERA in the 1970s and the Reagan Revolution in the 1980s. Since 9/11, Schlafly had been calling for an end to immigration and for a fence along the border, and Trump's call for a wall had won her loyalty. Donald Trump is the one who has made immigration the big issue that it really is, Schlafly said, because Obama wants to change the character of the country. That summer, Schlafly had attended the Republican National Convention to celebrate Trump's historic nomination. In a wheelchair, she looked weak and pale, and yet she spoke with her trademark determination. She said she wanted to be remembered for showing that the grassroots can rise up and defeat the establishment, because that's what we did with the Equal Rights Amendment, and I think that's what we're going to do with electing Donald Trump. Schlafly died only weeks later, on September 5th, 2016. Her endorsement, The Conservative Case for Trump, published the day after her death, called on conservative Christians to support Trump because of his positions on immigration and abortion. Christianity is under attack around the world, most dramatically from Islamists, but also insidiously here at home with attacks on religious freedom. Only weeks before the election, Trump delivered opening remarks at Schlafly's funeral at a Gothic cathedral in St. Louis. With Phyllis, it was America first, Trump said from the altar. He raised a finger, as if making a vow. We will never, ever let you down. On election day, at least according to exit polls, 52% of Catholics and 81% of evangelicals voted for Trump. Trump's election marked a last and abiding victory for the woman who stopped the ERA. Yet dissenting conservative Christians argued that it also marked the end of Christian conservatism. Though Donald Trump won the presidency in part with the strong support of Catholics and evangelicals, the idea that someone as robustly vulgar, fiercely combative, and morally compromised as Trump will be an avatar for the restoration of Christian morality and social unity is beyond delusional, wrote Rod Dreher after the election. He's not a solution to the problem of America's cultural decline, but a symptom of it. Dreher called on Christians to engage in digital fasting as an ascetic practice. Other conservatives who had not supported Trump wrestled with the consequences of the right-wing attack on traditional sources of authority and knowledge, but especially the press. We had succeeded in convincing our audiences to ignore and discount any information whatsoever from the mainstream media, former conservative talk radio host Charlie Sykes reported after the election, in an act of apostasy called How the Right Lost Its Mind. The left placed blame elsewhere. Hillary Clinton mainly attributed her defeat to a scandal over her email, for which she blamed the FBI, though she and her supporters also blamed Bernie Sanders for dividing the Democratic Party. At the Kennedy School post-election conference, neither the Clinton campaign nor the mainstream media was ready to reckon with its role in the election. At an after-dinner discussion about the role of the media in the election, Jeff Zucker, the president of CNN, rebuffed every suggestion that CNN might have made mistakes in its coverage, for instance, in the amount of airtime it gave to Trump, including long stretches when, waiting for the candidate to appear somewhere, the network broadcast footage of an empty stage. Frankly, respectfully, I think that's bullshit, Zucker said of the complaints. Donald Trump was on CNN a lot. That's because we asked him to do interviews, and he agreed to do them. We continuously asked the other candidates to come on and do interviews, and they declined. You showed empty podiums, someone hollered from the audience. Zucker refused to back down. Donald Trump was asked to come on, and he agreed to come on, and he took the questions. Those other candidates were asked, that's not true, screamed another campaign manager. Zucker, I understand that emotions continue to run high. The moderator, Bloomberg politics writer Sasha Eisenberg, called for calm. Let's move to a less contentious subject, fake news. During the campaign, voters who got their news online had been reading a great many stories that were patently untrue, pure fictions, some of them written by Russian propagandists. Russian President Vladimir Putin disliked Clinton. Trump admired Putin. During Trump's first year in office, Congress would investigate whether the Trump campaign had colluded with the Russian government, and even whether the meddling affected the outcome of the election. But the meddling, which appeared to consist of stoking partisan fires and igniting racial and religious animosity, had a larger aim, to destroy Americans' faith in one another and in their system of government. In any event, not all writers of fake news were Russians. Paul Horner, a 37-year-old aspiring comedian from Phoenix, wrote fake pro-Trump news for profit and was amazed to find that Trump staff, like Lewandowski, reposted his stories on social media. His campaign manager posted my story about a protester getting paid $3,500 as fact, Horner told the Washington Post. Like, I made that up. I posted a fake ad on Craigslist. Horner, who did not support Trump, later said, all the stories I wrote were to make Trump supporters look like idiots for sharing my stories. Horner died not long after the election, possibly of a drug overdose. Horner may have been surprised that people reposted his hoaxes as news, but a great deal of reposting was done not by people, but by robots. In the months before the election, Twitter had as many as 48 million fake accounts, bots that tweeted and retweeted fake news. On Facebook, a fake news story was as likely as a real news story to be posted in Facebook's news feed. At the Kennedy School Forum, moderator Eisenberg turned to Elliot Schrage, Facebook's vice president of global communications, marketing, and public policy. At what point did you recognize there was a problem with fake news? Eisenberg asked. The issue of our role as a news dissemination organization is something that really surfaced over the course of the past year, Schrage said. Congress would subsequently conduct an investigation into what Facebook knew and when it knew it and why it didn't do more about it. Mark Zuckerberg, who appeared to be exploring the possibility of someday running for president of the United States, had at first dismissed the notion that Facebook played any role in the election as crazy. During a subsequent congressional investigation, Facebook would reluctantly admit that a Kremlin-linked misinformation organization, the Internet Research Agency, whose objective was to divide Americans and interfere with the election, had bought inflammatory political ads from Facebook that had been seen by more than 126 million Americans. It later came out that Facebook had provided the private data of more than 87 million of its users to Cambridge Analytica, a data firm retained by the Trump campaign. Schrage, however, didn't speak to any of that. Facebook had only very recently begun to wonder whether it ought to think of itself as a news organization. I'd say probably the last 3 or 6 months, he explained. And it showed. Schrage, a corporate lawyer who specialized in acquisitions and mergers, displayed little evidence of any particular understanding of news, reporting, editing, editorial judgment, or the public interest. When he dithered about photographs with nipples that Facebook's algorithms had classified as pornography, but which might really be legitimate news stories, the Associated Press's Kathleen Carroll interjected witheringly, "Can I just say that news judgment is a lot more complicated than nipples?" Schrage shrank in his chair. At the start of Trump's second year of office, the Justice Department would indict 13 Russian nationals involved with the Internet Research Agency, charging them with posing as U.S. persons and creating false U.S. persons, as well as using the stolen identities of real U.S. persons to operate and post on social media accounts for purposes of interfering with the U.S. political system, a strategy that included supporting the presidential campaign of then-candidate Donald J. Trump and disparaging Hillary Clinton. They were also charged with undermining the campaigns of Republican candidates Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, supporting the campaigns of Bernie Sanders and Green Party candidate Jill Stein, using Facebook and Twitter to sow political dissent in forms that included fake Black Lives Matter and American Muslim social media accounts, and organizing pro-Trump, anti-Clinton rallies, posting under hashtags that included hashtag Trump2016, hashtag TrumpTrain, hashtag #1 I won't protect Hillary, and hashtag Hillary for prison. More revelations would follow. At the post-election panel, Eisenberg asked Marty Baron, esteemed editor of the Washington Post, whether he had considered not publishing the content of Democratic National Committee emails released by WikiLeaks, an anonymous source site established in 2006. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, an Australian computer programmer, styled himself after Daniel Ellsberg, the political scientist who had leaked the Pentagon Papers, But Assange, living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, bore not the remotest resemblance to Ellsberg. Russian hackers had broken into the DNC's servers. Assange had released the hacked emails on WikiLeaks, and the Post was among the media outlets that had decided to quote from emails that would turn out to have been hacked by a sovereign nation state. Barron, otherwise serene and oracular, grew testy, evading Eisenberg's question and pointing out, irrelevantly, that the Post had not hesitated to release the contents of the emails because the Clinton campaign never said that they had been falsified. Eisenberg asked Schrag why Facebook hadn't fact-checked purported news stories before moving them into the newsfeed rankings. Schrag talked about Facebook's learning curve. Mainly, he dodged. It's not clear to me that with 1.8 billion people in the world in lots of different countries with lots of different languages that the smart strategy is to start hiring editors, he said. As congressional hearings would subsequently confirm, Facebook had hardly any strategy at all, smart or otherwise, except to maximize its number of users and the time they spent on Facebook. Where's news judgment? Called out someone from the audience, directing the question at the entire panel. Zucker shrugged. At the end of the day, it's up to the viewer. He was answered by groans. Carol, a longtime eminence in the profession of journalism and a member of the Pulitzer Board, summed up the discussion. I know that there are some organizations or some journalists or some observers who feel like the media ought to put on the hair shirt, she said. I think that's crap. And the evening ended with no one from any of the campaigns or from cable news or social media or the wire services having expressed even an ounce of regret for anything. The election had nearly rent the nation in two. It had stoked fears, incited hatreds, and sown doubts about American leadership in the world and about the future of democracy itself. But remorse would wait for another day, and so would a remedy. If we should perish, the ruthlessness of the foe would be only the secondary cause of the disaster. The primary cause would be that the strength of a giant nation was directed by eyes too blind to see all the hazards of the struggle, and the blindness would be induced not by some accident of nature or history, but by hatred and vainglory. Reinhold Niebuhr, The Irony of American History, 1952. Epilogue. The question addressed. It had been unusually warm in Philadelphia, the summer of the Constitutional Convention. But by the middle of September, when the last delegates mounted their horses and headed for home, the weather had begun to turn. By October, when the Federalist Papers began appearing in newspapers asking Americans to debate the question of whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force, the air was as crisp as an autumn apple. In November, as the last apples were pressed into cider, the temperature began to plummet. The day after Christmas, ice closed the Delaware River and kept it shut for months, over a winter so cold that the ground froze as far south as Savannah. It's been hotter in the years since. The climate of the Constitution is gone. The average annual temperature in Philadelphia at the time of the Constitutional Convention was 52 degrees Fahrenheit. By the end of Barack Obama's presidency, it had risen to 59 degrees. When the world began to warm, the temperature over land rose faster than the temperature over water, but the oceans heated up too. Ice caps melted, seas rose, storms grew. Not long after Donald Trump announced that he would withdraw the United States from the nearly 200-member nation Paris Climate Accord, a declaration he described as a reassertion of America's sovereignty, a trillion-ton iceberg the size of the state of Delaware broke off of Antarctica. For millions of years, the continents had drifted apart from one another. In 1492, they'd met again, in America, a new world. 16th-century conquerors debated the nature of justice. 17th-century dissenters hoped to find nearness to God. 18th-century rationalists, cleaving themselves from the past, hoped to found a new beginning, a place out of time. The United States began with an act of severing. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Its constitution aspired to create a more perfect union, but it was slaves and the descendants of slaves who, by dissolving the bonds of tyranny, helped to realize the promise of that union in bonds of equality. Those new bonds tied Americans to one another and to the world. Telegraph wires stretched across the Atlantic sunk to the ocean's floor. Then came steamships, airplanes, supersonic jets, satellites, pollution, atomic bombs, the Internet. In the beginning, all the world was America, John Locke had written. By the close of the Cold War, some commentators concluded that America had become all the world, as if the American experiment had ended in unrivaled triumph. The American experiment had not ended. A nation born in revolution will forever struggle against chaos. A nation founded on universal rights will wrestle against the forces of particularism. A nation that toppled a hierarchy of birth only to erect a hierarchy of wealth will never know tranquility. A nation of immigrants cannot close its borders, and a nation born in contradiction, liberty in a land of slavery, sovereignty in a land of conquest, will fight forever over the meaning of its history. And still the waters rose. Trump's election started a tidal wave. Not a few political commentators announced the end of the republic. Trump's rhetoric was apocalyptic and absolute. The theme of his inaugural address was American carnage. The rhetoric of his critics was no less dystopian, angry, wounded, and without hope. As Trump began his term in office, Americans fought over immigration and guns, sex and religion. They fought, too, over statues and monuments, plaques and names. The ghosts of American history rattled their chains. In Frederick, Maryland, a Chevy pickup truck carried a bronze bust of Roger Taney, the judge who'd made the decision in Dred Scott, from the city hall to a cemetery outside of town. In St. Louis, cranes pulled up two Confederate memorials, their plinths spray-painted Black Lives Matter and End Racism, and put them into storage. New Orleans planned to take down monuments of four Confederate leaders, which led to mayhem, seepage from what secessionists once described as a sea of blood, the bursting of a dam. In Charlottesville, Virginia, where a statue of Robert E. Lee had been slated to come down, armed white supremacists marched through the city. One ran down a counter-protester and killed her, as if the Civil War had never ended, she the last of the Union dead. The truths on which the nation was founded, equality, sovereignty, and consent, had been retold after the Civil War. Modern liberalism came out of that political settlement, and the United States, abandoning isolationism, had carried that vision to the world. The rule of law, individual rights, democratic government, open borders, and free markets. The fight to make good on the promise of the nation's founding truths held the country together for a century during the long struggle for civil rights. And yet the nation came apart all the same, all over again. Conservatives based their claim to power on liberalism's failure, which began in the 1960s when the idea of identity replaced the idea of equality. Liberals won gains in the courts while losing statehouses, governor's offices, and congressional seats. By the 1990s, conservative Robert Bork insisted, "Modern liberalism is fundamentally at odds with democratic government because it demands results that ordinary people would not freely choose. Liberals must govern, therefore, through institutions that are largely insulated from the popular will." But the problem wasn't that liberals did not succeed in winning popular support. The problem was that liberals did not try, spurning electoral politics in favor of judicial remedies, political theater, and purity crusades. Conservatives rested their claim to political power on winning elections and winning history. The National Review, William F. Buckley had written in 1955, "stands athwart history, yelling, stop." From wanting it to stop, conservatives began wanting history to turn back, not least by making a fetish of the nation's founding in the form of originalism. From the arrival of the English-speaking colonists in 1607 until 1965, Newt Gingrich wrote in 1996, from the Jamestown colony and the Pilgrims through to Tocqueville's Democracy in America up to Norman Rockwell's paintings of the 1940s and 1950s, there was one continuous civilization built around commonly accepted legal and cultural principles. Since 1965, the year Lyndon Johnson signed the Immigration Act, Gingrich argued, that civilization had come undone. Gingrich's account of America's past was a fantasy, useful to his politics, but useless as history, heedless of difference and violence and the struggle for justice. It also undermined and belittled the American experiment, making it less bold, less daring, less interesting, less violent, a daffy, reassuring bedtime story, instead of a stirring, terrifying, inspiring, troubling, earth-shaking epic. And yet that fairy tale spoke to the earnest yearnings and political despair of Americans who joined the Tea Party and who rallied behind Donald Trump's promise to make America great again. Nor was the nostalgia limited to America alone. All over the world, populists seeking solace from a troubled present sought refuge in imagined histories. The fate of the nation-state itself appearing uncertain, nationalists who had few proposals for the future gained power by telling fables about the greatness of the past. Barack Obama had urged Americans to choose our better history, a longer, more demanding, messier, and finally more uplifting story. But a nation cannot choose its past. It can only choose its future. And in the 21st century, it was no longer clear that choice, in the sense that Alexander Hamilton meant, had much to do with the decisions made by an electorate that had been cast adrift on the ocean of the Internet. Can a people govern themselves by reflection and choice? Hamilton had wanted to know. Or are they fated to be ruled forever by accident and force, lashed by the violence of each wave of a surging sea? The ship of state lurched and reeled. Liberals, blown down by the slightest breeze, had neglected to trim the ship's sails, leaving the canvas to flap and tear in a rising wind, the rigging flailing. Huddled below decks, they had failed to plot a course, having lost sight of the horizon and their grasp on any compass. On deck, conservatives had pulled up the ship's planking to make bonfires of rage. They had courted the popular will by demolishing the idea of truth itself, smashing the ship's very mast. It would fall to a new generation of Americans, reckoning with what their forebears had wrought, to fathom the depths of the doomed Black Sea. If they meant to repair the tattered ship, they would need to fell the most majestic pine in a deer-haunted forest and raise a new mast that could pierce the clouded sky. With sharpened adzes, they would have to hew timbers of cedar and oak into planks, straight and true. They would need to drive home nails with the untiring swing of mighty arms, and with needles held tenderly in nimble fingers, stitch new sails out of the rugged canvas of their goodwill. Knowing that heat and sparks and hammers and anvils are not enough, they would have to forge an anchor in the glowing fire of their ideals. And to steer that ship through wind and wave, they would need to learn an ancient and nearly forgotten art, how to navigate by the stars. If we should perish, the ruthlessness of the foe would be only the secondary cause of the disaster. The primary cause would be that the strength of a giant nation was directed by eyes too blind to see all the hazards of the struggle, and the blindness would be induced not by some accident of nature or history, but by hatred and vainglory. Reinhold Niebuhr, The Irony of American History, 1952. Epilogue. The question addressed. It had been unusually warm in Philadelphia the summer of the Constitutional Convention. But by the middle of September, when the last delegates mounted their horses and headed for home, the weather had begun to turn. By October, when the Federalist Papers began appearing in newspapers asking Americans to debate the question of whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force, the air was as crisp as an autumn apple. In November, as the last apples were pressed into cider, the temperature began to plummet. The day after Christmas, ice closed the Delaware River and kept it shut for months, over a winter so cold that the ground froze as far south as Savannah. It's been hotter in the years since. The climate of the Constitution is gone. The average annual temperature in Philadelphia at the time of the Constitutional Convention was 52 degrees Fahrenheit. By the end of Barack Obama's presidency, it had risen to 59 degrees. When the world began to warm, the temperature over land rose faster than the temperature over water, but the oceans heated up too. Ice caps melted, seas rose, storms grew. Not long after